go ahead and get started. So today I would like to talk about a technique that is useful for designing and controlling systems and stability and such. It's a little bit dated in that earlier years we would teach you all the detailed ways to calculate these things by hand, but this is another one of those topics today. You've got a nice MATLAB tool that will let you visualize it and all that. So we'll go through the technique relatively quickly because there are some details to how you compute these, what's called the root locus, but we won't require that in this course to have that level of understanding since you can just plug it in the MATLAB. But I do want you to be aware of what it is and how it's used because it's still important in understanding stability issues. Also, I guess we're working on the date for the last exam, or do we just throw up our hands and decide to keep it where it is? I think some are waiting on another exam to be scheduled.
Yeah, we're waiting on circuit for some exam, but he's finally scheduled it. What date is it?
It's next Wednesday.
Anyway, so get with Kyle. Just if we're going to move it, let's try to give at least a week notice for that. So we're kind of running out of time, but I don't mind moving it around to avoid these conflicts, especially since that means you'll all get 100 on the exam if I schedule it at the right time, right?
Yeah,
I'm like that.
So sometimes it's better to have excuses, right? Okay, the root locus. Recall our simple control system to the right, where we have a plant, E of S, which we talked about last time. We're not necessarily able to directly control, so we want to put some kind of control circuits in the open loop path and in the feedback path to allow us to be able to control the system. So the overall transfer function of the system is C of S times P of S over 1 plus C of S, G of S, P of S. And that's found just by taking the open loop gain over 1 minus the closed loop gain. We talked about how to do that last time, or you can just write the transfer function the way we have in the past. The controllers C of S and G of S can be designed to stabilize the system, but that could involve a multidimensional optimization. Instead, we'd like a simpler, more intuitive approach to understand the behavior of the system. So recall that the stability of the system depends on the poles of 1 plus C of S, G of S, P of S, which is the denominator. Why is that the case? Why does the stability of the system depend on the locations of the poles of this polynomial?
It depends on the size of the imaginary axis.
Right, so what happens if one of the poles of this polynomial happens to be in the right half plane? Why is that system unstable? Right, exactly, because when you take the impulse response, when you take the inverse Laplace transform of this, you're going to get at least one term that has an e to the alpha t where alpha is positive, so the impulse response will increase. So a root locus in its most general form is simply a plot of how the poles of our transfer function vary as the parameters of C of S and G of S are varied. So we'll show in a moment how we do that, but it's a way of visualizing what happens to the system as we, for example, play with the gain of the open loop gain or the feedback gain of the system. So the classic root locus problem involves two simplified views. We either have a gain placed in the open loop path, so we have k times h of s over 1 plus k times h of s times g of s, or we have k placed in the feedback path, so we have h of s over 1 plus k times h of s, g of s. So the question we'll deal with today, k is a constant, what happens as we vary K? How does that influence the stability of the system? And does that allow us to actually control the system just by varying that gain? And you'll notice that in these two systems, no matter where, even though K is in a different location, the poles of the denominator are the same. So the stability of the properties of the systems are going to be the same. So let's look at, let's go back and review our simple first order system. So we have C of S is going to be K, G of S is going to be a full, just one, straight feedback, and H of S was 1 over S plus 2. So last class we wrote the transfer function Q of S as K over S plus 2 over 1 plus K over S plus 2, which when we multiply by S plus 2 over S plus 2 gives us K over 2 plus over S plus 2 plus K. And we observe that the pole of this system is at S equals to minus 2 plus K. Now, what the root locus involves is plotting the location of this pole as a function of K. As we vary K from 0 to plus or minus infinity, how does the location of the pole vary? So when K is greater than 0 here, what happens to the pole location as I increase K?
It's to the left.
Right. This term just becomes more and more negative because K is positive. We have a minus here on the quantity. So this term just becomes more negative. So this line represents what happens when I go from K equals 0 to K equals infinity. When K is less than 0, we go from minus 2. When K goes to minus infinity, we have minus and minus infinity or plus infinity. So this path goes from minus 2 out to plus infinity. So when K is greater than 0 and I increase K, the system becomes more stable. When K is less than 0, the system becomes less stable. So we observe then that improper adjustment of the gain can cause the overall system to become unstable, or conversely, proper adjustment of the gain can cause the system to be stable. What happens to the overall impulse response as I increase K and the system becomes more and more stable? How would you observe that in the overall impulse response of the system? What's the general impulse response of this system?
Exponential.
E to the minus alpha t type, right? Right. So what happens as you increase alpha?
It's more and more dampened.
It's more and more damped, right? So the impulse response.
So it does reach steady state faster.
And right. What would you say that the impulse response is if it's less responsive?
Right, well that was sort of what I was getting at. So imagine, so this is what happens when I increase K. So you could think, so there are many ways, many real life examples that could correspond to this. You could think about, for example, adjusting the damping on the suspension on a race car. As essentially the process of adjusting K. And as you make K larger, what's going to happen to that? Usually they have like a hydraulic damper, it's going to become stiffer and stiffer. And that may or may not be a good thing. Depends on whether you want to drive like a race car or a truck.
With those kinds of feedback loops and stuff, they even feed data into it so that it knows how to adjust itself? Like,
or well, I mean, that's the point. So this could be, in terms of physical system, this could actually be a shock absorber, and this could be an adjustment on, and I don't know nothing about shock absorbers other than what they look like from the outside, but something that adjusts the stiffness of the spring or the the ability to compress the hydraulic fluid. Anybody here know anything about shock absorbers?
Don't they have some that rely on electricity?
Yeah, I mean, they have electrically controlled shocks. In fact, I think the one time the vehicle they were building in Cavs was looking at those. Now, so you have the basic device itself. On a race car, this might be a baffle, this might be a shock absorber, this might be part of the suspension. Then you have what you put around it to control it. That could be electronics or that could be mechanics. In the olden days, we had the wonderful air shocks. I don't know if people remember when these came on the market. And you used to have a little air connection in your trunk of your car, and you'd pump them up with air if you wanted to be stiffer or to hold more weight.
Air suspensions?
Yeah.
Is that like hydraulics?
With a lot of state-of-the-art things, they have, for example, electromagnetically controlled shocks now, where all wrist control is actually electronic. So that's kind of interesting, because you can actually implement fairly sophisticated digital filters to give you many different kinds of behaviors for the car. And in fact, I think some of the really high-end, high-performance sports cars, you can actually program the profile of the car so that it drives, handles different ways and different types of road conditions and things. Yes?
Okay, so earlier, did you say that if any one of those blocks is unstable, the entire system is unstable?
No, we're looking at the overall stability of the system.
Okay, so...
And that's what this transfer function represents.
Okay.
It could be we're doing this because this particular system is unstable, or we just want an ability to control it and dampen more. But I just wanted to point out that when you make a system more stable, what you tend to do is make its impulse response die faster, which could be a good thing if it's vibrations on a bridge. It could be a bad thing if it's trying to make something a little pliable, like a shock absorber or something.
Is HFS the response of the plant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, that should be P of S.
Okay.
And so this is a simple game where we're just putting a constant here, and G of S is just a pass-through. Okay, so that's the easy case. It gets a little more interesting when we look at second order systems. So in this example, we'll have a proportional controller, an amplifier, and then a motor. And in a moment we'll see some examples of these kinds of things. And we want to basically look at how we can control this system as a function of K. So this system, again, the transfer function is going to be the open loop gain over 1 minus the closed loop gain. So in that case, we get K over S plus 100 times S plus 1 over 1 minus a minus K times the same thing. So the transfer function is now K over product of these two poles plus K. So the first question we might ask is, how does the step response vary as a function of K? So here we have various values, various plots of the step response as a function of K. When K is zero, the system has a very simple, overdamped type of response to it. When K is equal to 10, very similar response, but the amplitude of that response goes a little higher. There's a little bit of change of scale here, unfortunately. When K is equal to 100, we get still the same kind of response, but the amplitude is actually increased now to 0.5, the steady state value. When K is equal to 10 to the 3, we get a similar thing. Now, when k is equal to 10 to the 4, we now start to see critical damping. I mean,
critical damping would be somewhere between 10 to the 3 and 10 to the 4, wouldn't it?
Right. Well, we see...
Once you get overshoot, that's underdamped.
Right. So the step response is starting to oscillate a little, which means the impulse response is starting to oscillate a little. And when we increase k now, you see, notice this is the steady state value here is 1, so we have the oscillation. So as k increases, the system goes from too little gain, you could say, to too much gain. So there's an example, too little gain. There's an example, too much gain. You can tell, by the way, in the notes, when I was doing these notes for the first semester, students were getting really bored, so I've added a few more animations. Time goes on, but animation is a good title to get over pretty quickly. So what we want to look at next is how do the poles move. So here we have the transfer function, which we can factor using the quadratic equation into its poles. And we can look at the location of the poles as a function of k. So for k equals 0, the poles are at -1 and -100. As I increase k, those poles start to move. So we start at poles of -100 and -1, which is very close to the j omega axis. As I increase k, those poles move in until we hit a point where the poles then, this thing goes negative and we get poles which are imaginary. Which have an imaginary component to them. So this is a root locus for this particular system. We see as I increase k, the poles move towards this point, and then they diverge along the j omega axis. So can we generalize this analysis to systems of arbitrary complexity? Well, fortunately, MATLAB has support for the root locus. Very easy to do in MATLAB. You set up your polynomial as before. You invoke the transfer function formula or function call, and then you can call a function which will take that transfer function as an argument and produce this root locus plot. So pretty easy in MATLAB. What the question really is, well, what's the use of this plot? Well, system designers, when they're dealing with trying to understand how to design a system to be more stable, particularly for more complex systems, the plot will become useful because you can actually use it to determine what kind of feedback control and what kind of damping and such that you might want to put on a system. So that point of convergence there becomes important because that's sort of on the verge where it becomes, that's the point at which it becomes critically damped. Now, the more general case is a little bit more difficult to understand and to visualize. And in the textbook, they do go through what you might call the classic control systems analysis of this and try to teach you how to construct the root locus for general polynomials. We won't really dwell on that in this course. If you go into the controls course, you may study that in greater detail. But for this course, we just want to give you sort of a flavor of how this works. So if we have a general transfer function, closed loop poles are the roots of this equation. When this equation is equal to 0, which means that g of s times h of s must be equal to -1/k. It is much easier to plot the root locus for higher order polynomials because we can usually determine the critical points of the plot from limiting cases. We can look at things like what happens when k goes to 0, what happens when k goes to infinity, And then you can connect the critical points using some simple rules. So the root locus is defined as traces of S for unity gain. So we have, going to make it even simpler and just say, let's assume k is equal to 1. Let's solve this equation of k times g of S, h of S is equal to 1. So we can draw some general conclusions. If k is equal to 0, g of S and h of S, when k is equal to 0, g of S times h of S must be equal to infinity so that this equation is established. So S 0 are the poles of g of S and h of S. When k is equal to infinity, g of S and h of S must be 0. So S 0 becomes zeros of g of S, h of S. So that's our, this insight gives us some ideas about where to start. Start at a pole at k is equal to 0 and end at a 0 at k is equal to infinity. And we can go a little bit farther and say that the numbers of zeros and poles to the right of the locus point must be odd. I'm not really going to dwell on that point today, but let me just show you what this looks like in a more general case. So here we have g of s and h of s is s plus 2 over s times s plus 1, just as an example of a particular control system. And this is the root locus that corresponds to this system. So we start at k is equal to 0. We move towards this point. And then, as we keep increasing k, we move towards this point, and then again we move towards this point, and ultimately arrive at k is equal to infinity. So this contour here represents what happens to the pole locations of this polynomial, 1 plus k, h of s, g of s, as we vary k from 0 to k is equal to infinity. So this polynomial, g of s, h of s, has two roots associated with it. So we're essentially going to be worried about how those roots move as a function of k. And if you go through the calculations, you'll see that kind of a locus. And this is for the case where k is greater than 0. Now for k less than 0, we're going to start at 0 and at minus 1, because these are the two roots. And we're going to move from minus 1 to infinity, this point where k, as k goes to minus infinity, and we're going to move from k is equal to 0 out here for the 1 over s pole.
So in the second graph, the system is stable as k goes to infinity, but not as it goes to 0, or is greater than 0? Is that what that says?
In the
between 0 and infinity.
In the second graph, this graph?
Yeah.
No, this is a positive real axis here.
Yeah, so if k is greater than 0, then... Oh.
When k is less than 0, the system is unstable because of this pole.
Okay, so k must always be greater.
When k is greater than 0, the system is stable because everything's in the left-hand plane.
Where does that ellipse come from?
This, again, you're just going to be solving for the roots of this, and the way these things tend to go is at some point the roots become, the term under the quadratic, under the square root, becomes negative, and you get, you have two poles here,
They're conjugates,
right? And then they go, and then they'll go to be complex conjugate pairs. Now, again, in years gone by, I could actually teach you about properties of polynomials and why this contour has to look this way, and we can talk about the number of times you circle the origin and all this stuff based on the order of the polynomial. We don't really do that anymore. We spare you all that. Just plug it into MATLAB. But you can actually relate, in the controls class, if you study this, you will relate some of this to Bode plots and something called gain and phase margins and things like that. We won't really, again, go into that level of detail here. But from a control point of view, you can look at the locations of the poles and you can tell a lot about the overall response of the system. So a system designer will look at this and make some decisions about the kind of values that K should be depending on the type of application. And the system, the application engineer will know where the poles have to be positioned to get the right kind of stability that you'd like. And that's just that depends on the application, it depends on the physical constants. If you're working on damping an acoustic auditorium, you're going to be working on time scales of 1 second or so. If you're working with a race car, you may be working on time scales of a quarter of a second, you can then design the controllers based on that. But the plot is useful because it tells you generally what the behavior of the system is going to be as you increase the gain or decrease the gain of your damping and or your controls on the control system. So, so you're all thinking, well, that was a waste of time. So let's actually talk about some interesting stuff, how you can actually put this stuff to use. So I'm going to talk about two things, an inverted pendulum and one of my personal favorites, which is the robot riding bicycle. So the inverted pendulum was one of the major advances in systems theory in, I think initially this was like the mid-70s or something, but you've all probably played the game where you've tried to balance a baseball bat, right? When the baseball bat's turned upside down. And we all learn that a pendulum, of course, is the natural point of stability for pendulum is vertically downward, right? If you move the pendulum, it's smart enough to know it should come to rest here, right? But what was known for many years was, well, this a pendulum pointing straight up is actually a point of stability as well. But it's, a point of unstable equilibrium, I think is what the physicists used to call this. And why is it considered an unstable point of equilibrium?
Because any input will drive away from
stability. Right, so if there's the slightest deviation, it will not go back to its point of equilibrium like the downward pendulum. It will never reach its point of equilibrium if you deviate it slightly. So that's a very bad thing in a system because that says it's very fragile. Any kind of deviation and you're never going to return to that nice operating point. So then people started to think, and it only took like 200 years of mathematics to do what any four-year-old kid knows how to do almost instantly. People started to think, well, what would it take to balance a pendulum vertically? To build a control system that would balance a pendulum vertically. Now, for many years, this was an unsolvable problem. Of course, I don't know why, maybe control systems theorists don't play baseball when they're young, but those of you who played baseball, you know the game, right? There used to be this game where you hold the bat and people kick it or something to choose sides or something like that. I don't even remember how it goes. But you've all done this kind of a thing, right? So what's the trick in balancing the pendulum vertically? Aside from being really, really stable.
Even the way it's falling, it's falling.
Yeah. You have to build a system that as the pendulum shifts in a particular direction, you have to move it in that direction. So the pendulum has its mass above its pivot point. It's often implemented with the pivot point mounted on a cart so that it can move horizontally. That's one of the ways you solve this problem. A normal pendulum is stable when hanging downwards. An inverted pendulum is inherently unstable. So you must actively it must be actively balanced in order to remain upright, either by applying a torque at the pivot point or by moving the pivot point horizontally. There's a very nice wiki page on this, and there's a number of videos on thanks to YouTube and such, and let's watch this thing. And I think we have, hope we have audio. So this is a demonstration of the inverted pendulum. You can see a couple things. You can see with small deviations, it goes back to its right place. But even more interesting is you can see that when it's actually pushed downward, it will figure out how to right itself in this position of unstable equilibrium. And it's done by simply shifting the base to provide that proportional kind of feedback, so that the system will be stable.
So can it bring itself up from...
No, that's what he's demonstrating now. From if it gets too far down with no momentum or no inertia, it'll settle in the vertically down position.
Well, couldn't it couldn't it just oscillate?
Yeah, like, good if you program.
Yeah, you could do. You could have it start swinging.
There you go.
There you go. Right there.
Yeah. Senior design project.
Tilt sensor, microcontroller.
Useless fun thing to play with.
So that's a very nice example of advances that have been made in control theory in this area. And like I said, I think the theoretical work was done in the late 70s, but you didn't start seeing actual demonstrations like this until we had DSPs and hardware that was capable of doing all the calculations fast in real time.
Are they using a similar process to that for these robots that have to walk on two legs?
Well, that's my next thing. So we have the robot riding a bike, which is really much more interesting. I mean, it's a much more advanced version of this, but this was very impressive at the time that it was done. So here he's demonstrating that small deviations are easily corrected. But what's really this is ability to correct under such large deviations. But so this is an example of why you need active feedback, because it's constantly measuring the position and adjusting.
That is cool.
So Dr. Koshka's feedback lecture didn't have that.
No.
I've been talking to him ever since you guys made that comment.
The history lesson about the Ukrainian flag.
Yeah. If you want to get him upset, just tell him he's Russian. One of the ways to get Pastor really upset is tell him he's Russian.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't want to get him upset.
Well, prior to the Cold War, post Cold War and all that, everyone from that area to American was Russian, right?
Yeah.
Now with the
former Soviet
Union. With the dissolving of the Soviet Union, there's like 57 countries now, and they're all very sensitive about that, as you would expect. So
could we just call him a
communist? He won't actually mind that. He's a socialist, but
oh wow.
He's a good guy. We have a lot of you just get to know him. He has a lot of really interesting views about
people's bank,
politics and things and free market economies and such. So, what's used in this demo is proportional derivative control, and the equations describing the physics are actually shown over here. We won't go into this too much, but this is all done by solving second-order differential equation So it's not terribly complex. And that's another, I think, thing about this that I like to point out is that even though the actual physical system may be very, very complicated, with first or second order models, you can do quite a lot with these systems. So if you actually take into account all the physics of that pendulum and the friction and the motors and the joints and wind resistance, you'd end up with a very complicated set of equations. But a simple second order model, which just generally models the gross behavior of the system, is fine, because you're going to have this active feedback system controlling the system and constantly adjusting. So as long as it's sort of overall behavior is in the right ballpark, it'll be able to balance the pendulum. It doesn't need to know about third order, fourth order, fifth order effects, all these really complicated things. So apparently, you know, the block diagram for that system is described here, and you've essentially got motors controlling the way the cart moves back and forth and such to balance the pendulum. And there's feedback from the motors, and then there's feedback from the pendulum position. And both of those feedbacks are used. But ultimately, what you're doing is you're controlling the gain. And I think you're also controlling the alpha, if I remember right. So not a very complicated system to implement to balance the pendulum. But you have to... As the pendulum starts to tip, you have a decision not only about moving in that direction, but sort of how fast you're going to move in that direction. And if you remember, we talked about overshoot and undershoot. One of the practical issues you'll have to deal with is if you move your cart too fast, the momentum of your cart is going to be hard to stop. You won't be able to stop the cart on a dime. And if you do stop the cart on a dime, you're going to create another jolt to the pendulum. So that's why I was trying to get across that these second order systems, where you're always kind of balancing undershoot, overshoot, and damping, these are really important models in real life, because you need usually those 2 degrees of freedom to be able to get these kinds of systems to work in practice. So you have to think about how fast you should accelerate the cart so that you don't overshoot the amount of correction that you need. And if you don't do this careful way, you're going to be making far too many adjustments instantaneously, and you'll never be able to balance the pendulum. So as simple as that looks, there is a lot of tuning that goes into getting the cart to kind of move smoothly to keep the pendulum balanced in real time. So here's another schematic of these kinds of systems. I think this is a schematic that actually came from that system. And it gives you a little bit more idea of from a mechanical point of view. It's a mechanical system, but it's ultimately controlled by electronic feedback. And you've got, well, it just sort of describes the degrees of freedom that you have in terms of the motors and things. So early 1990s, I think, is when this was started. People got a little bit more ambitious with the advent of low-cost digital signal processing chips. This was the first time I saw this demonstration was by a graduate student at University of Toronto, which was done for a competition that Texas Instruments held every year. They offered $100,000 to the student project or the university project that used DSPs. That was sort of the coolest demo. And this demo, when it was first shown, really blew people away because it involved multiple systems working simultaneously.
What year was this?
This particular demo came off of YouTube. I don't remember the day. I think this is more recent. But I saw there's a The earlier version of it had a much less sophisticated robot, and that was done for the first time, I think, in 91 was when I first saw that video. This version came out of Japan, where you can kind of tell by the style of the robots. So here we have a robot riding a bicycle, which is an amazing, it really is an amazing combination of robotics. And when these were developed, you know, initially it was just getting the robot to ride straight. Here they demonstrate actually turning. So of course with turning now, you have to have the robot kind of lean into the bike. If you know, you've all ridden bicycles, I'm sure, and you know how easy it is for humans to learn this, but how difficult it is to program machines to do that.
How long did they have the robot on training wheels? That's what I wanted to know.
But it gets more interesting, as you'll see. I don't think this, but this was impressive. This was something that robots can do that humans actually can't do, at least before they had all this X Games stuff. I couldn't do that in my generation. But I don't know if you've ever watched X Games kinds of stuff, but the things people do on bicycles these days is just amazing. But balancing the bicycle at rest is very interesting. Now, the original demo I saw, I couldn't find a videotape of it, shows also the robot going over bumps. And this is one of the really impressive things, that the ability to ride a bicycle over bumps, which involves a lot of really active, very quick feedback control, because once you hit the bump, the bike is going to start to wobble, and you have to know how to adjust to that in real time. So this is another example of the use of this kind of active feedback control, and it's really a very impressive application of it. And there's others. There are a lot of other videos of this genre. In the email archives, you'll see some pointers to eight-legged robots. There's apparently there was a competition to build a spider type thing that could actually climb up stairs and climb over rough terrain and things like that. And that's an interesting, another interesting kind of control problem. Walking as if you don't know, is a very complicated procedure, so we all can. And getting robots to walk has been taken many years to get that to work right. And I'm sure Brian Jones can tell you all the details of why this is so complicated. But they've got this desire to have vehicles that can traverse very rough terrain, like for moon, Mars exploration and things like this. One of the more state-of-the-art tasks right now, I don't know if you follow the DARPA competition that they host every year, where they try to have cars autonomously drive a course in the desert out in Death Valley. And the first year that they ran this, many of the high-powered research groups in robotics participated in this, including many top universities. And it was really interesting because the first year they ran this, when the vehicles took off, about half of them apparently just fell into the first ditch. It was really kind of funny to see like millions of dollars go off the edge just like that. But the robot that won in the first year they were very smart, actually. They figured that all the fancy, high-powered control algorithms were going to fail at some point. So they went very, very slow and used very simple but reliable control procedures. So they took many hours to traverse the course. I don't remember if they made the course in the right amount of time. I think they were longer than they were allowed, but they did. They were the only vehicle to finish the course in the first year because they figured all these fancy cars are going to try to go really fast, we're going to crash, and they would just kind of, you know, let everyone else crash and they'd be the ones left standing. So the first year they won it, people were kind of, well, that wasn't very interesting, but they've held the competition several years now, and the vehicles are getting really impressive, and these vehicles have cameras on them, so they're doing image recognition, and then they figure out how to steer around objects. And the course itself is not trivial. It's got a lot of obstacles, and and things. So you have to be
pedestrians.
What?
Pedestrians.
No. That's well, you know why DARPA wants this, right? But no, these things can't shoot anybody yet. But but I am actually there in my graduate class last semester. I had a company come in. I had some students from the company in my class, and they're building. They build acoustic arrays that you can deploy, and they can detect gunshots. And these have become very of great interest for detecting gunshots in urban areas, or like when you have snipers and crowds and all this kind of stuff. And then there's companies that actually build guns that you can couple into the system, and when given the coordinates for the location of the shot, will actually turn and fire. So yes, they have autonomous systems that can actually detect gunshots and shoot. Now, if you've ever seen the movie RoboCop or anything like that, you know, this is getting a little bit scary, but they are deploying these kinds of systems. Another variant of that that's used to protect some really important aircraft are they have laser arrays that sit on aircrafts and actually try to shoot down missiles and things in real time. And this is sort of the extent to which this is used on Air Force One is one of the great secrets, but they have been developing for many years now these arrays that have can move in three dimensions essentially and can track objects and shoot them down with lasers. And there's a great interest for the applying those things to problems where you have very fast moving objects like mortar shells and things in very close proximity. So these are really interesting control problems because, sorry, I'll get your questions in a second, but because the, when you're trying to, and you people who work on CECON probably have some experience with this, but when you try to move an object and actually shoot, you have to worry about the inertia of the object. It's not simply as simple as just, you know, moving it and shooting, because by the time you'll overshoot the position if you don't take into account the inertia of the object. And that's again where this overshoot, undershoot kind of principle comes in with the second order system. If you want the object to move smoothly and shoot, you have to take into account the inertia that's going to happen as you're moving that object. I think you had your hand.
When you talk about lasers, are you talking about chemical lasers?
What?
Chemical?
Yeah, well, light lasers, yeah. Yeah. What other kind are there?
You know, like these are some arrays can be made chemical in some sense.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on lasers, but I mean, these are your standard high-powered lasers, the same things they use, like, in Las Vegas to make things look really cool. But,
you can go to Boeing's website and look at this, I think.
Do they have some information on those?
I think so. I think Boeing's the one that's making all of them.
They're set on something I think they call an octopod, if I remember right, but I don't remember the specifics of it. But so there's also another application that's emerging, which is interesting, are unmanned aerial vehicles. They're actually developing the ability for what they call swarm intelligence, a group of these vehicles to autonomously communicate between themselves and operate so that one operator can manage maybe 100 of these vehicles. Right now, for every one unmanned vehicle, you've got at least one operator per vehicle, so it's very labor intensive. They'd like to be able to just launch a swarm of these and let them go do their things under the control of one person. So a lot of different, really interesting applications for this kind of control stuff.
So when do you think Japan's going to send an ice mode robot to Mars?
Japan has made an enormous investment in robotics. I mean, the robots that they're producing are getting really scary. I don't know if you've seen some of the latest with really human-looking features and things. But
I know one of the later ones can run.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's running. I've seen a couple demos recently. I can't remember.
We taught him to walk.
What?
We taught him to run.
We taught him to kill.
We taught him to kill.
Call me this.
Okay. We'll see you on Wednesday.